The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening in. My guest today is Steve Santangelo of the SRS Rocco Report. He writes about gold and silver and oil and shale oil, especially lately. And we're going to be talking about that. Speaking of gold and silver, it's been quite a turbulent month here in August of 2018 in the international currency markets. And so a word on behalf of our sole sponsor here at the Kunstler Cast, ICA Financial Management. You need to own physical precious metals in your portfolio. Whether in your possession, in an IRA, or stored internationally, it's imperative that you work with a company that advises you on and manages your gold and silver. ICA has been an industry leader since 1972. Your ICA advisor will get you set up correctly from the onset and keep you informed about when to make a move, when to add ounces, and even assist you with an exit strategy as markets change. So call 1-800-525-9556 for a free portfolio review. That's 1-800-525-9556. Or go to icagoldcompany.com to request information. Steve Santangelo, out west in the Rocky Mountains somewhere. It's a pleasure to talk to you again. You've been writing quite a bit for the last couple of years about economics, and in particular, the oil scene and the shale oil scene and the gold and silver scene. And we're going to touch on some of those things today. You are one of the few voices out there that actually sees a connection between the energy predicament we're in and the financial scene. We can count on one hand the number of commentators out there who actually get that. What's so hard to get about that?
You know, I think this is the highly specialized nature of the world. You know, there are a few. You've been talking about this for a while. Chris Martinson is another.
There's probably Thornburg.
Yeah, and so they've been talking about this, but I think the issue is, and I even bring it up with other precious metal dealers and analysts, but they, I don't know what it is. People tend to get stuck in this kind of specialized field, and they focus on that. Like some might focus on manipulation, and that's it, or some focus on mining. But when you look at it, you know, energy runs everything, so you have to look at the energy. That's the common denominator. And so if you don't do that, the analysis or how you see things working out in the future, they're going to be a lot different. And I'll give you an example. Peter Schiff, I used to watch him on Fox Business and CNBC talking about the coming mortgage meltdown and stock market meltdown in 2006 and 7, and he was right. The problem is he doesn't know anything about energy, and so he thinks if we can just allow the banks to go under and start maybe a new system on sound money, then we're going to be fine, and we're not. We just don't have the energy to do that.
Yeah, it's a curious thing because he is one of the more savvy commentators out there, and yet he doesn't seem to get that at all. But I think we'll see that the financial end of it will play out somewhat along the lines that he's suggesting. But if he put this together with the energy situation, I think he'd have a more coherent view. Today, we had another frequent occurrence, the 6 a.m. slam on precious metals in the metals markets. As I understand it, you're not a believer that in the manipulation scenario that we hear about.
Actually, I am a believer in the manipulation. I do believe that there is market rigging. market intervention. And if you want to call it manipulation, heck, they've manipulating LIBOR. I mean, even a few bullion banks and these large banks have been guilty of rigging precious metals. They paid a fine. And so we know what's going on. But I think there's a lot more to it than just looking at how the markets, how the gold and silver are manipulated. There's a lot more to it. So I look more on the medium to long term on the precious metals than the short term manipulation. And so we can get into why I differ.
Let's do that right now. Tell me.
Well, even though there's been a lot of analysts, Ted Butler, Harvey Organ, they've been talking about the constant manipulation. Even Harvey Organ, I believe he went to the CFTC meeting back about 10 years ago and with GATA and to give some indication of how he saw this is happening. If we look at all the supposed manipulation and price hammering, the market price of gold, Jim, is still about 5% above the total cost or the adjusted income cost of the gold mining industry. They're still making a little bit of money. Mm-hmm. At the silver price at about $15.50, $16, that's about what it takes to mine primary silver. And so some of them are losing a little bit of money, some of them making a little bit of money. But now if the price of silver or gold was 20, 30% below the cost of production, same with copper, same with oil, lead, all of those things, then I would say there is blatant manipulation. And then I think if that happened, Jim, if we saw prices of gold go to like $1,800, mm-hmm. traders who are very savvy, who understand this cost of production, they would be buying gold hand over fist. So it seems like the manipulation to me is what they're doing is they're capping the price. They're keeping gold and silver, but like it happened in 2011 and 12, they're keeping it off the radar from the public. They're managing the up movement in the precious metals, but they're not pushing them below what it costs to produce them. So that's where I see this kind of market rigging taking place.
What you're describing is kind of a fine-tuned engineering scheme to keep the price of gold capped at just enough for the miners to make money, but not enough to really reflect badly on the value of the dollar, because it seems to me that what's behind this is really a institutional defense of the U.S. dollar.
Precisely. And I think the issue comes down to something like the cryptos. When Bitcoin started going to 20,000, we start hearing about cryptos a lot on the mainstream media, financial networks. But, you know, a year before that, no one really knew about them except a few geeks. And so if the price of gold started shooting up to 1500, 2000, these kind of price movements wake up people, because most traders aren't really smart. They go after the price movements. And so keeping gold and silver kind of languishing now around their cost of production, it does exactly what you said. It keeps the public. It keeps them kind of brain damaged. They're left out of the loop.
Well, the metals holders must be majorly discouraged and demoralized after 7 years of going nowhere. So what might you say to them in the way of reality testing?
I've spoken to some precious metal dealers, and from what I understand, you're right. Ever since Trump was elected, the demand for precious metals, as well as most like prepping, survival, gun ammo, food storage, all those kind of sales have plummeted 75-80% across the board. And we can look at the Silver Eagle sales at the U.S. Mint. Currently, they're at 7.7 million. They may hit 10 million this year. Well, two, 3 years ago, they were doing 40 million. So it's 75% less. So, but the issue, what's happening is that the large investor, the wealthy investor, is still buying. Maybe not as much as they were a few years ago, but they're still buying. Who isn't buying?
Well, Ted Butler on the Chris Martinson podcast called Featured Voices says that J.P. Morgan is the principal buyer of silver.
Yeah, and I kind of differ a little bit about the analysis that Ted Butler, and let me start off by saying I started listening to Ted Butler back in 2001, which was the reason why I purchased my first ounce of silver in 2002 for $4.58 an ounce. But I differ a little bit with Ted Butler's analysis about J.P. Morgan, but getting back to this frustration, yes, a lot of precious metal investors are frustrated, but those who look at it more of insurance and understand these underlying fundamentals, they're still very secure in their ownership, and they still continue to buy the metals. But it seems as if this 7 years, especially the last few years, where it hasn't gone at all, the prices haven't gone really at all, it's added more to the frustration. And I do empathize, but I do think we're going to start seeing a change probably starting this fall, because there's just too much insanity in these markets. So I think we can talk about that, but I do think these markets are highly leveraged and with debt and margin, and we're going to see probably fireworks starting this fall.
Well,
and
so can the authorities lose control of this engineered fine-tuned capping?
Yes, and this is how I look at it. It all comes back to the energy. I've heard this a million times. The central banks can always rig the paper markets, and they can. They can bail out the auto industry. They could bail out the shale oil industry. But if we look at the amount of oil that's being discovered, it's 10% of what we're using. Now, you see, that's what they got to fix. They can't fix the paper. They got to fix how much oil we're bringing in, we're discovering. And it's not this unconventional shale stuff. That's not profitable. We're kind of cannibalizing the whole system to keep that running. So I think as time goes on, the central banks, while they may be able to prop up, bail out pension funds, bail out whatever, they have to work on getting more oil.
Steve, that would require tremendous amounts of capital or money that we have stopped spending on exploration. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, why would we have any reason to believe that there are large amounts of conventional, you know, easy to get and easy to produce oil out there?
Jim, there aren't. That's the
right.
That's the catch 22.
Which is there exactly why they're not, you know, making capital expenditure on exploration.
Precisely. And so, but when I get this conversation, the debate that the central banks can always manipulate, they could always backstop the market. If they're going to truly backstop the market, they've got to bring on more oil. They've got to find more oil, and they can't. And what's funny, I think last year, Rystad Energy said the world found 6.7 billion barrels of oil equivalent natural gas and oil. Mm-hmm. And now this year, they said it's a remarkable recovery. We're up to 4.5 billion barrels in the first 6 months of the year. That's still peanuts. If it turns out to be the same for the second half, it's 9 million barrels.
And just still, so the listeners understand, we're talking about replacing the oil that we burn every year with new oil.
That's precisely right. And we're burning about 60 billion barrels of conventional oil and gas. They call it barrels of oil equivalent. So even if it improves a little bit this year, it's still a sixth of what we're burning. I think 2012 was the last year we placed half of what we're burning. In 2011, it wasn't as high. So the problem is you have to look at the energy, and the energy is in big trouble, and the shale industry is in big trouble. So when I look at the end of the market rigging, I look at when the markets start to crack, and this is how I see it. I see the stock market and the real estate market, it's going to happen like 2008. We already peaked, I believe, in the beginning of this year. And so we're going to have a correction, and there's so much leverage now. When the correction hits, it's going to correct in a violent manner, and that will bring down the oil price as it did in 2009. We have to remember, and you remember, it was 145. It fell all the way down to 30. I see the similar thing happening over the next 2 years. So as the price of energy corrects with this correction that's overdue, we're nine years into this cycle, and we're definitely overdue for a correction, that's going to really pull the plug on the shale oil industry when oil prices fall again.
You know, we did see in 2009, the price of gold and silver fell quite a bit as people sold their gold and silver, you know, to make their margin calls or to raise capital or do whatever they had to do in a crashing market at the time. And I would expect something similar this time around. I would expect initially people to sell off, you know, whatever gold and silver they were holding. But then I would expect a serious bounce as people discovered that other financial instruments no longer had any value.
Well, you know, that may happen, but there's a wild card that it may not either. And let me explain. Mm-hmm. In 2008, the Dow Jones average was about 80% trading over its 200-month moving average. And that's a technical thing, but it was about 80% higher. Silver was trading 245% higher than its 200-month moving average. It was like $6. It was trading at 21 right when the markets corrected. Mm-hmm. Well, today, the Dow Jones is 85% above its 200-month moving average. And guess what? The silver price is 2% below its 200-month moving average. I'm not saying it can't go below that. Well, again, the cost of production in 2006 was probably right around $6, $7. Mm-hmm. And now it's about $15, $16. So we could see a decline in the silver price or in the gold price. But gold and silver are much closer to their bottom. If silver was trading at $30, $40 now and gold was trading at $1,700, $1,800, yes, I would say we would see a massive correction in gold and silver, but they've been kind of languishing lower for the last several years. So we may get an arm jerk correction, but I think it will be short-lived because I'll say one last thing. In 2016, when the stock market had a 2,000-point correction, Jim, it was the second most highest record inflows of gold ETFs. I think the investors were panicking because there was a correction in September, October, but then it came again in January. So they thought this was going to be the big one. And we had gold and silver took off as the price of the Dow Jones fell. It may not turn out as it did in 2008. We could see a correction, but I think they'll recover much quicker as the markets continue to sell off.
Mm-hmm. One phenomenon that we saw over the last 24 hours was the interest rate on the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond went back above 3%. That's kind of a magic hash mark for the benchmark 10-year U.S. bond and a kind of a spooky place to be. Is this as hazardous as some observers have been saying?
Yes, and I'll tell you one place where it's hazardous. The interest expense that the U.S. is paying in the first 9 months of this year is $40 billion more than it was last year.
Mm-hmm.
That's due to increase in debt, and it's due to the higher interest rate now. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jim, $40 billion of extra interest expense that they have to pay, that just goes to show you when the interest rates, if they get out of control, if the Fed loses control of the interest rates, I believe we're going to see the annual interest expense rise to about $480 billion. Let's say half a trillion. And that's based on maybe a 2.5% interest rate average. If it goes to 5%, 6%, or 8%, that makes the interest expense over $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm. And that's just for the U.S. government servicing its debt. There's the whole realm of corporate debt out there, which includes the shale industry.
Yes. And as the interest rates start to rise, so will the interest rates that the shale companies, and you know, they've been doing this Ponzi scheme, right? With they can't pay back their debt. Now, some have paid back debt, but they sell an asset.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they issue a new senior note at a rate, let's say 15 years or 10 years away, and then they pay off the one that's due now. But if the interest rate rise, they have to pay a higher interest expense. And we're seeing that the interest expense that the shale companies are paying continues to increase.
That's kind of a fiasco with a cherry on top.
That's a fiasco. Yes. The reason we had this ability of the Fed and central banks to prop up the markets, especially the U.S. market, they did the big bailouts and then they dropped interest rates. Well, we added oil production, even though it's kind of crappy oil, but it's still oil. We added about 5 million barrels of oil production. I think it's almost six now, mm-hmm. in the last 7, 8 years, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think they could have done that without the oil. You need the energy. It's like we got in the depression in the 30s. You needed the energy to pull us out. We had the extra energy, even though it was a great energy. This time around, this next market correction, I think the whole world is going to be kind of at a peak. I'm not saying every country, but especially if you have a deflationary oil price. So this next time around, I think the shale oil will not be there to save us. This next central bank, the wizardry that they try to do, we won't have the energy to pull us out.
Well, an awful lot of companies that are active in shale are not making a red cent on their operations. They're just sinking deeper and deeper into this kind of Ponzi of rolled over unpayable debt. What percent of the industry do you think that represents?
Well, I know Art Berman has been doing some pretty good work on this, and I looked at the top, so let's say some of the larger shale companies in the first quarter 2018. Of 10, 7 of them were negative free cash flow. They were losing money. Mm-hmm. And 3 of them were making money, but not a lot of money. But when we look over a 10-year period, like I look at Chesapeake, which is now the third largest shale gas producer in the United States, they have had 15 years of consecutive negative free cash flow. Mm-hmm. Their debt was $2 billion in 2003. It's now $9 billion. So they still have to pay that off.
Oh, man.
And so this is, if you look at the shale companies as a whole, not singularly, there are a few that are making money. But as a whole, the industry continues to lose money, even in 2018. Now, let's say if these shale companies stop producing, they stop drilling, then they would be cash cows. But they have to drill because their share price would collapse. So it's a catch-22. It's one of those catch-22s. They're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't.
Well, do you have any insight about why would they even bother continuing these operations if they just don't make money and they're just hopelessly in a trench of debt that they'll never get out of? What's actually keeping them in there? The lack of any idea what else to do with their company?
It's the Amazon psychology, right? Amazon hasn't made any money selling its billions of products retail online. Mm-hmm. It's only making money through its Amazon cloud services. It's breaking even, cost cutting and destroying the whole retail supply chain. It's destroying the whole supply chain by breaking even. At least Walmart, when Walmart did that to the mom and pops, they made money. Amazon is breaking even, destroying the retail chain. So it's kind of the same thing with shale. It's that same mentality, because if you talk, Jim, with some of these conventional oil guys that have been around for 30, 40 years, they'll tell you, we drill a well. They're still drilling vertical wells. There's a few guys out there still getting conventional. They have a good time. They laugh. They hire about 50 people, and they make money doing it. And they pay everybody in 30 days, and they didn't borrow any money. Mm-hmm. But the whole shale thing is a Ponzi scheme because they had to go public to get the financing to continue this operation. So I think it's a mentality. It's the Bernie Madoff mentality, and it looks good, and the investor relations makes it look good, and people believe it. But when you start looking at the numbers, they don't make sense. And I'm surprised, Jim, that more energy people besides Art Berman, a few others, I'm surprised that the industry continues with this U.S. independent energy, and it's surprising to me.
I'm not really, because they're sort of defending a position that they feel they have to defend. I'm not at all surprised that it produces delusional behavior. From what I've seen, I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me that the two original shale oil regions, the Bakken in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford in South Texas, are either heading into decline or well into decline. This must come as an unwelcome surprise to the shale oil cheerleaders. What about the Permian Basin, which is the biggest of them all and really kind of the final frontier of shale oil in the USA?
Well, the Permian was the last one to come on the block. And we know that in the region, in the Permian region, there's probably about 1 million barrels a day of conventional and I think 3 million barrels a day or 2 million of the unconventional shale.
And by the way, they've been pumping the Permian for conventional oil for 100 years.
Right. And so, yeah, they've been doing it, and it's still kind of profitable, and it makes sense. But it's not above 1 million barrels. But when you see the Permian and you see all these the shale oil, if you look at the way it's over a long period, it's gone up like exponential. I'll give you an example. Pioneer is the largest shale producer in the Permian. They spent I think it was $818 million. It wasn't all in the Permian, but they spent $818 million in the first quarter of this year. They only added 9,000 barrels of production in the Permian. After spending $818 million, and on top of that, their free cash flow was like a negative $240 million.
An ugly picture.
It's an ugly picture. And I don't see how this continues forever. It will continue for a while. And I do think when the market's correct, we see lower oil prices, it will be the factor that really pulls down the shale oil industry. Even without that, these fields are going to peak because now they have to start moving outside their sweet zones. Here's the interesting thing. The sweet zone wasn't profitable.
Yeah.
You get outside the sweet zone, it's really unprofitable. So that's what they get to look forward to.
Well, where exactly are the Bakken and the Eagle Ford basins right now in terms of their production history? Have they, in fact, gone over the peak?
According to the EIA, the Bakken has now surpassed its peak of 2000, beginning 2016. And the Eagle Ford is still, I think, 200,000 barrels below its peak. I think in the future, we're going to have serious issues with what's happening in the Bakken. I think some of the numbers aren't right. I can't go on and give any more information than that, but...
Well, there's a lot of room for monkey business in, you know, any of this statistical analysis.
I think you're right. I think that's what we're seeing because the Eagle Ford hasn't recovered. It's still 200,000 barrels below its peak. But why is the Bakken now, you know, rising above its peak? I do feel that we're going to see the beginning disintegration of the shale oil industry in the U.S. within the next 1 to 3 years. And especially once we get a lower oil price, because and you know what's interesting? People keep saying when the oil price gets to 100, then the shale industries are going to make a lot of money. Well, don't they realize as the oil price increases, the shale drillers or the contractors, the leasing agents for these drilling equipment, they raise their rates. Do they think pipe is going to stay the same price if oil is going to go up another 30-40%? So cost will increase as the oil increases.
They're even having a problem with getting the kind of sand that they need to use in the fracking to keep the fractured rock open so the oil can get out.
They're now using frack sand from Texas, but it isn't as good of the quality of frack sand that they have from, I think it's Michigan. Mm-hmm. They've been trucking that all the way down, but they're using so much of it. You're right. I don't think the energy return on investment for shale oil, I think a number was 5 to 1. It's got to be much less than that because they're not making the money. So this is how I look at the shale industry. It's nothing but pipe. It's nothing but water. It's nothing but chemicals. It's nothing but sand. It's a whole bunch of fleets of trucks moving around with all this equipment and all this labor. And then that's it.
It's a tremendous amount of activity with really no net profit for the society.
There's no net profit for the companies, really. And then the companies are supposed to pay taxes. They're supposed to help the local economy with taking care of the roads. And as you know, these trucks are destroying the roads in North Dakota and Texas. It takes a fleet of trucks. And I saw a study, Jim. I think one typical shale well, it's almost like 500 to 800 truckloads to get that shale load and to move the water and the fracking sand and all the equipment. And then you've got to move the oil. A lot of this oil isn't piped. It's trucked out.
Yeah.
So it's a massive amount of trucks moving around and destroying roads that the shale industry is not, they're not footing the bill.
Mm-hmm. How fragile do you think the U.S. oil industry is?
This is how I look at it. In 2008, we had the collapse of the housing market and the investment banking industry. Lehman Brothers, that was founded after the Civil War, is gone. Bear Stearns, gone. And so it was a tremendous, tumultuous time in the financial industry. And it looked pretty bleak. I think gold went up $100 in just one day when it looks like the CD market was freezing up. But then the oil industry was in relatively good shape, Jim. The debt on the balance sheets of some of these small companies that became the shale companies, I think Continental Resources is the poster child of what's wrong. They had like $250 million in debt. They were paying $15 million a year of interest expense in 2005.
That sounds like a lot, but it's actually very little compared to where they are now.
Yeah, now they're paying $750 million, a third of a billion in interest expense, and their debt now is $6.5 billion. So the oil industry in 2008 was still in relatively good shape. Now it's a mess. So to me, even though you still have ExxonMobil, I have Chevron and ConocoPhillips, they're the three majors out there. They're doing a lot better, and not much in some instances, but I think by 2025, this is the best way to put it. By 2025, I see U.S. oil production down by 50 to 75%.
Wow.
If we look at some of these declines already, if there isn't a lot of new drilling, they fall off a cliff within a few years. And most of the increase has been due to shale. I see U.S. oil production by 2025, 7 years, I see it down by at least 50%. And so, and then there's going to be issues with other countries like Venezuela. Mexico is in trouble. And so then what does that look like in our country? Are we going to be able to import that oil that we're losing from the shale industry? And I think it's going to become a lot more problematic. I think we're going to start to see what you call is the end of suburbia. It's going to finally start kicking in the next decade.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought about whether or not the government may make an attempt to nationalize this wobbling industry as economies start to fail?
Well, they did help out the auto industry, and they didn't nationalize it, really. No, they didn't.
They bailed it out.
And they also did the same thing with the, you know, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae.
But I guess, this isn't a one-time bailout. I mean, you could bail out some current debts, but in order to continue doing what they're doing, they got to keep on racking up more debt.
And I think that's the issue. And it comes down to what is known as the energy return on investment and the thermodynamics. And this has been a new kind of study for me. And it's really how much energy, net energy, is making it to the market. And there's two things going on, Jim. You've got the energy return on investment, and that tells us how much, if you put one barrel of oil cost and you get, let's say, 10 barrels of oil out of it, that's one thing. Well, then there's the thermodynamics that suggests that early on, a lot more of that energy in that barrel made it to the market. So if you had 10 barrels, you know, let's say 10 years ago going to the market, you had a higher amount of that net energy if each barrel, but now it's falling because the industry is just sucking so much energy to produce this energy. So even if the U.S. government nationalize, I don't think they'll nationalize, but even if they tried to bail out somehow, backstop the oil industry, it does mean more debt. And as I mentioned before, we have to be finding more oil, good oil. We can't use paper anymore. Paper won't continue to solve our problems. And even with that, these shale wells, just the high decline rates, at some point in time, you can't keep robbing from Peter to pay Paul. And as we know, the pension system is a mess. So all this leverage and debt in the system, you can pile more onto it. But I think it just exacerbates the issue. I don't see a bailout or a backstopping of the oil industry to save it for much longer, to allow it to live that much longer.
Mm-hmm. It just kind of defies the laws of physics.
Yeah, because it's all about the net energy. You know what? I think about this issue. The Roman Empire is similar to the U.S. Empire. And the Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire, it fell because it had a very high energy return on investment. And it did well in its initial stages by acquiring new lands, by acquiring their wealth. It took that wealth. It made bigger armies. These armies took over further lands. But at a certain point, it reached a peak, and it couldn't go to Persia. The Romans couldn't attack the Persians because it was too expensive to do that. But they could attack the Germanic tribes, but there really wasn't any wealth up there. Mm-hmm. So then they had to kind of sustain what they had. And unfortunately, an agricultural energy return on investment of 5 to 1 back then wasn't high enough. And so the United States is in that same predicament. We're in the same predicament. And so what the Roman emperors are doing, they would start going after the wealthy towards the end of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, the landholders in particular, the people who own large productive agricultural estates, and they stopped producing.
The farmers did, yes. And because they were taxing on what they were doing, then they stopped producing it, and then they start taxing them on what they should have produced. But they were also going after the wealth of the wealthy elite, mm-hmm. because that's where the stored economic energy was. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. shale industry is stealing energy. Investors who have invested $250 billion plus, most of them are not going to get that money back. I would say most of them will not get that money back. I can't give you a percentage. But that money was some economic energy that was swindled from the system. So that's what's happening now.
You know, in the course of that swindle, you get some interesting blowback. In the case of ancient Rome, the blowback was the severe loss of value of Roman money. In other words, inflation. And it was deliberate. You know, removing the silver from the denarius coin.
That's an interesting point you brought up, because we could see the denarius fell in value over several hundred years, and it fell very quickly towards the end.
Yeah.
But the dollar's done the same thing. The difference is, and this is what we don't tend to focus on, is the Roman Empire didn't have a lot of debt. I'm not saying they didn't have any debt, but the problem is we have all this digital debt out there.
Well, they also didn't have instruments, financial instruments, nearly as complex as ours and so congenial to fraud.
I've been watching some of these pretty good analysts, and there's, from what I understand, there's over $5 trillion in global ETFs. And the thing is, when the market starts to correct, they're saying there's really not going to be a bid for that stuff.
Yeah. And explain to the listeners what an ETF is, would you?
It's an electronic traded fund, and they're designed differently. But an ETF is a basket, or it's kind of a bet on a bet. And so it's not really, let's say, IBM, but it's a bet on IBM. It is an electronic traded fund that has part of IBM in it. And that's kind of the same thing as a derivative. A derivative is a bet on a bet on a bet, and it continues to get more exotic. And let me add one more thing. The margin debt in the industry was at an all-time high last month. It was at $670 billion debt. And that's the traders' margin debt in the United States Stock Exchange, as well as the other exchanges. That's just the U.S. And now that is $170 billion higher than the peak in 2007, which was $500 billion.
Mm-hmm. This may sound silly to you, but explain to listeners what margin is, because it has a slightly abstract ring to it.
Small and large traders can trade on margin. A typical investor who doesn't want to do that, they put $5,000 in an account and they buy, let's say, a stock, and they invest $5,000. Now, someone who wants to go on a margin account will borrow the money. Let's say they want to borrow $5,000 from the TD Ameritrade, Scottrade. So now they're borrowing money to buy these shares. So now they're controlling $10,000, $5,000 of their money and $5,000 of the broker's money. They own those shares. Well, as the margin debt increases, and we've seen it in the 90s up to 2000, and we saw it from 2000 up to 2008, when the margin debt increases, so does the indexes on the S&P and the stock market. We're at a peak now on this margin debt. I'm not saying it can't go higher, but it's 30% higher than it was in 2007. And in 2000, it was only $450 billion. So we're seeing that the margin, the debt, and the type of investments that people are investing in, gosh, it's a giant Ponzi scheme, really.
National League scoring futures?
Yeah.
Just saying.
Right.
Tell the listeners what a margin call is.
Well, let's say the price of your stock falls below the price that is indicated when you purchased it. The problem is now, when that price falls below your purchase price, now you owe them the money that you borrowed, and it could go so far against you. So this is the reason when there's a margin call, when the prices start moving violently, then it's like you, everyone thinks, well, I'm going to react slowly. I've got my stops, this, that, and the other. But sometimes markets just, they just drop, just like Facebook did, right? A few days ago.
A rush to Facebook, the exits.
So if you had a margin bet on that, you got hammered. I mean, you were taken out to the woodshed. So margin can work for you when it's going in the right direction, and it can seriously hurt you when it goes in the opposite direction. And when that starts to happen, as the margin debt starts to fall, so will the stock markets. And it's kind of like a snowball effect. That's how I see things playing out. Jim, I am surprised that these markets have gone on this long. And normally it's a 7-8 year cycle. We're now in 9 years. It could go longer. But this market now is propped up by the most leverage and debt and insane assets that I've ever seen.
Well, I think the interventions have been so enormous that they've simply disabled the markets, and especially their main function of price discovery, which is to say the main job of a market to tell you what the value of stuff is, you know, whether it's a stock or a bond or some commodity. And they just don't do that anymore. You know, these are markets that are effectively disabled and flying blind.
Yeah, I know Chris Martinson has mentioned this. If we compare the increase of real things and compared to the financial instruments, it's off the charts. And it should be more equal. You shouldn't have so much leverage in the financial system. And so, and this always gets back to the reason why I look at the precious metals as more of a true store of value, because they're a store of economic energy, and they have been for thousands of years. Nothing has changed. Unfortunately, the central banks and Wall Street have bamboozled the public into funneling their funds into these highly inflated assets. It looks good when everything goes up, but it turns out to be really horrible when it goes in reverse.
Yeah, the margin to me seems to be a way of, on the way up, of pretending that you don't really have any skin in the game, and on the way down, of letting you know that you have all the skin in your body in the game, and maybe your internal organs too. So how do you account for the complacency in the public arena, and including especially the news media, about where this story is going?
You know, it's the old story. The public is fickle. The public tends to forget. We tend to be, it's like this cycle. It happens over and over again. There's the boom and bust cycle. I mean, the shale oil industry is a typical boom and bust. You look at the amount of oil increase, it's a boom. And anything that moves up that way comes down the same way. And so the same thing with these markets. And again, people don't do the thinking. I'm outside the system. I try to do the critical thought, look at things more objectively. But you see, I'm not paid by a broker. I don't work for CNBC. So most of these people really can't be objective, because they have to kind of follow the line. And the line is everything is well, everything moves higher, and this is the way it's going to be until it isn't. You talk about the delusional thinking. It's gone to an extreme level this past year or so, especially with the, you know, what's going on in the White House and the media. That's a whole subject on itself.
Right, and I wanted to ask you about that. It seems to me that there is a direct connection between the extraordinary political disorder that we're seeing and kind of the cultural disorder, you know, the fact that the intellectual class in America seems to have lost its mind collectively. There seems to be a relationship between that disorder and the dysfunction that is keyed to our lurking anxiety over the falseness of our economy.
Yeah, one is a physical illness and one is a mental. It seems to go hand in hand. And you know, as I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, the alternative media, who are people who focus on, let's say, outside the mainstream media, they thought Trump was going to be the savior that would make everything all right. And in some ways, he's done some interesting things. What's happened, it's this false sense of for the alternative media. And so we've seen this huge decline in interest in trying to protect yourself from whatever, you know, a financial meltdown or store food. And so it's the alt media has lost its way, as well as the mainstream press has kind of, it's they're both delusional now. And I find that because my readership has fallen considerably in the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying anything different. Matter of fact, I think some of the work I'm doing is better than what it was 2 years ago, but people aren't interested. Mm-hmm. They've kind of like, well, things are going to, and it's, people tend to believe in this ongoing narrative that, you know, we're going to have energy independent. I still get people emailing me, Steve, you must be off your rocker. We're going to be energy independent.
I had one this morning from a guy. I get him every day. You know, a disruption in some vital supply chains in our economy would sober up the public a lot. How would you describe the kind of disruptions that we face?
It all comes back to the energy. And as I think we're going to experience, I call it Seneca cliff-like declines in oil production. And it doesn't matter how many EVs we're going to produce. They're not going to help the situation. Solar won't help the situation. If you have paid for solar on your home, you want electricity, hey, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But for the masses, solar, wind isn't going to work. It never would.
I don't see it working without some kind of underlying support platform of fossil fuels.
Exactly. You need the fossil fuels to make the green energy work. When the system starts to unravel, I think it's going to unravel more violently than we expect, even though we could see. Look what happened with Venezuela. The people in Venezuela 5-6 years ago would never thought what they're dealing with now. I think when we start seeing these cliff-like declines in oil production, because I do believe in Lucius Seneca was this ancient Roman philosopher, and he said, the way to growth is slow and sluggish, but the way to ruin is rapid. And I do think that's the way systems tend to fall apart. Nothing falls apart slowly. Uh-huh. It falls apart quickly. So when we start to see this oil production fall, it's going to cascade. It's going to cascade, and it's going to be very disruptive because everything is based upon just in time. I'm not wishing for this, but if you look at it like a doctor would look at a patient who has this illness, you know, you can kind of forecast what's going to happen over time. And so to me, we're going to see major disruptions in the financial industry, in the housing industry. You know, I've said this on several interviews. You know, within 10 years, I see U.S. Real estate prices falling 75%. Mm-hmm. Because you need lots of cars and trucks moving around to give that real estate value. Mm-hmm. So if oil production falls, then the value of that real estate is not there. And then there's also all the debt that's tied to the real estate. So to me, I look at a much different world. I think the United States will be a much different place by 2025 with or without the political, you know, circus.
That's an interesting note for us to conclude on. And I want to thank you very much, Steve Santangelo, for coming onto the podcast. Will you please tell the listeners where your website is and what you're doing on it?
All right. Thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure. I run the SRS Rocker Report. You can find it at srsrockerreport.com. I put out 2 or 3 articles a week on the energy, the gold and silver industry, the mining industry. It's very fascinating what's happening in the mining industry. And I also talk about the economy. And I've just started doing some videos on my new YouTube channel, which is the SRS Rocker Report YouTube channel. And some people, it's easier to explain some of these more complex things on a video. So I just started that a few months ago. But it's always a pleasure talking to you, Jim.
Well, Steve, I'll check in with you in the fall when we may see some pyrotechnics out there on the scene that we've been talking about. I'll just say we will ride again.
That sounds great, Jim. Looking forward to it.